Hey, it's Diane. On my mind, Joe Biden wraps his first trip abroad as president. He met with European allies and Russian President Vladimir Putin. His message, America is back. And not just back, but front and center on the world stage. European leaders seem to embrace him and the return of U.S. leadership. Biden's meeting with Putin led to no immediate breakthroughs on issues like recent cyber attacks, human rights violations, and territorial aggression. But the president's supporters say the stage is now set for a more meaningful dialogue. David Rothkopf is CEO of the Rothkopf Group and longtime analyst of the U.S. role in the world. He joined me Friday morning to talk about President Biden's trip and foreign policy challenges ahead. David, what were your top takeaways from the Biden visit abroad, and most specifically, his exchange with Vladimir Putin?
I felt that it was an extremely professionally managed eight-day trip. And you know, in many respects, that's my top takeaway. This was not a trip that was going for the headlines. It was not really a trip that was just about the photo ops. It was part of a systematic diplomatic initiative to reset America's role in the world. And, you know, you could look at each step of it and see something concrete in that regard. He met with Boris Johnson in the UK, and they talked about revitalizing the Atlantic Charter. They met at the G7. The United States committed to 500 million doses of COVID vaccine. The rest of the G7 committed to 500 million more. So together they committed to 1 billion. And they had a number of other concrete steps, but that was a major one. They went to NATO, talked about a revitalized NATO alliance, undid some of the damage done by the previous president. But specifically, I think it was important that President Biden underscored his commitment to Article 5, which is the NATO article, you know, requiring a defense of all members of NATO, because, you know, more than anything he said to Vladimir Putin, that sends the strongest possible message, which is if you, you know, toy at the borders of NATO, we will respond collectively. And similarly, you know, the previous president was quite dismissive of the EU, but Biden went in and they announced probably 8 or 10 major initiatives with the EU, including the resolution of the trade dispute between Boeing and Airbus that I remember as an issue when I was in the Commerce Department during the Clinton administration. So, you know, that's been around a long time and it was quite substantive. So, you know, by the time he arrives in Geneva, he's got this message. NATO's back together. We're tight with the EU. The Atlantic Charter is strong. He shifted some of the priorities to China. He's saying we're looking towards the future. And we know what we're doing. And you know, in 2.5 hours or 3 hours with Putin, there was no way he could say anything that was as significant as what he did in the prior week.
So considering the fact that all of those international leaders know full well that a new election is coming in 2022 and President Biden could lose that very delicate situation in both the House and the Senate, how much faith do you believe they showed in President Biden, considering the accomplishments you just mentioned? Were they exhibiting any careful sort of doubt about what could come next.
Well, you know, Biden said and repeated, you know, the message was America is back. I think for all of our allies, the question is for how long? And, you know, you're right to raise the issue because I've spoken to some people, senior people in Europe since the trip, and the response is kind of cautious optimism. You know, there was a Pew poll that showed that in 12 countries that they polled, confidence in Biden's leadership was 58% higher than confidence in Trump's leadership. In other words, 17% had confidence in Trump and 75% in Biden. So there is a clear shift. But, you know, I think everybody is watching to see, you know, is the United States, you know, making a turn or a return to traditional leadership roles with Biden? Or is Biden the aberration?
So is it a longing of faith or is it a longing of hope?
Honestly, I think at this point it's hope. You know, you can't look at a country that had 4 years of Donald Trump, that's had many years of Mitch McConnell, that had a coup attempt on January 6th, for which none of the organizers seem to be held accountable, is unable to even get its act together enough to have an investigation into a coup, or for that matter, into the 600,000 official dead, 900,000 likely dead of the worst pandemic in history, half at least of which died as a result of bad government policies. You know, there's no reason for anybody to have faith that the United States is going to get it right, particularly when, you know, most polls suggest and history suggests that the Republicans will win back the House and the Senate in 2022. And we know what Mitch McConnell will do. We know what Kevin McCarthy will do if that happens. And they're trying to rig the system right now with voter suppression laws. And there doesn't seem to be a consensus even among Democrats about how to stop that. So Biden's doing it all right, but you know, the Congress certainly isn't keeping up with him.
You said that Americans need to understand that following this trip, the world is safer. What leads you to make that statement?
Well, we're safer because one of our principal assets as a country, national security assets, is an asset that almost no other country has, and that is a network of alliances worldwide. And those alliances were neglected and even undermined by the prior president. And this president came in and said, no, the alliances are top priority to me. NATO is a priority. Our ties to countries like the UK and to entities like the EU is a priority. Having a working international system, as you know, evidenced by the G7 meetings, is a priority. And what's more, you know, we're 5 months into the Biden presidency. There's a lot of evidence to suggest this, you know, this is not one-off stuff for the benefit of the cameras the past week. We re-entered the Paris Accord. We're renegotiating the JCPOA with Iran. We re-engaged with certain United Nations agencies, re-entered the World Health Organization and started funding that again, COVAX, the program to provide vaccines to countries in need, et cetera. So, you know, this is a man who believes in the international system. And the reason I think we're safer is because I believe in it too.
So the question becomes how powerfully or otherwise is the American public influenced or impressed by what Biden accomplished among the allies? And to what extent could that overturn the predictions, the history of losing after a presidential win, losing big time in the Congress?
I think the three instances where that hasn't happened in the past century, where the party that won the presidency maintained its lead, were all circumstances where the country was in some kind of crisis or faced some kind of special exigent circumstances. And I think the key with Biden is going to be the degree to which he communicates to the American people, and the American people perceive that this is once again one of those circumstances. I think we're going to be out of the COVID crisis pretty much by then, which perversely may not help. But I think we're in a crisis for American democracy. And I don't overstate that. I don't say it rashly. If massive voter suppression is underway, if one party is embracing undermining election results, challenging them even without evidence, and if there is no check on that, we're in trouble as a democracy. I think Biden understands that, and he's cast his whole presidency, domestic and foreign policy, as a contest between democracy and autocracy worldwide and at home. If he can say, you know, we've got to step up or we're going to lose the whole thing and people buy it, you know, maybe we'll be able to hang on to those things, you know. But I think we have to remember it's going to be against higher odds. A lot of states, you look at some of these things like this crazy audit in Arizona. You know, they're looking for bamboo in ballots because, you know, it suggests that maybe the ballots were sent from China. I mean, insanity. You know, if that kind of thing continues and proliferates and there's 25, 23 states that behave that kind of way, that have voter suppression measures afoot, oh boy. You know, it's not just going to be the mid-year curse. It's going to be the curse of a decaying democracy.
I also wondered along that line how Mitch McConnell's statement that even if there is an opening on the court, he would not allow Joe Biden to succeed in having a new person on the court. How do you think that might affect voter thinking?
Well, I think it'll affect it just the way it has, you know, since Mitch McConnell kept Merrick Garland off the court. And Mitch McConnell has been pursuing his scorched earth policies throughout his time as the leader in the Senate. Democrats will be outraged. They'll be shaking their head. They'll be pointing out his hypocrisy. They'll be condemning him. Chuck Schumer will be saying, you know, tough things about him. Nancy Pelosi will say tough things. And the Republicans just won't care. You know, they only care about winning. McConnell only cares about winning. All the Democratic condemnation, you know, it sounds like, you know, I don't mean to make light of it, but it sounds to them, I think, a little bit like Charlie Brown's teacher in the Peanuts, you know, cartoons, which is kind of wah, wah, wah. They don't hear any of it. You know, I don't know that it has an effect, but, you know, I think we have to be aware McConnell is actively an enemy of democracy. McConnell is willing to burn everything down in order to maintain power. And most of the Republican Party is willing to go along with that, or even some of the more extreme views of Trump, because they see their coalition as such that if they don't, they will lose 10, 15, 20, 30% of their support and their funding, and they'll lose their elections. And so they're kind of being held hostage by the most extreme parts of their party. And they're, you know, they've bought into scorched earth, and the Democrats have bought into clutching their pearls. Because we Democrats aren't taking action to stop them.
I want to ask you about Biden's sit down with Vladimir Putin. How did you think that went?
I think it went as well as it could have possibly been expected. But Putin showed up on time. Putin showed up before.
Which is a miracle.
It is a miracle. He kept the Pope waiting once. He kept Obama waiting. He played these kind of super childish, you know, games about, power games. But he showed up on time. He was there first. Biden came second. He spoke first afterwards. Biden spoke second. That was just smart sort of statecraft on the part of them. You know, Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor, was quoted in the Washington Post the day before the meeting or 2 days before the meeting as saying, Biden is entering this meeting with the wind at his back. What he meant was that all these events that I talked about earlier had happened the week before. So Biden was coming in. And, you know, you could even see it from the body language. You know, Putin was sitting there with sort of splayed legs, looking like the tough guy, but also looking a little bit like kid who was called into the principal's office. And Biden sat there serenely, looking like a president. Biden, you know, brought Tony Blinken into the first part of the meeting, as Putin brought in Lavrov to the first part of the meeting. Then they opened up the meeting. It was not the kind of Trump behind closed doors, you know, kind of thing. And, you know, even in the news conference, you know, and subsequently, Putin, you know, said Biden was there together. He's professional. He knows what he's doing. You know, some of the Trump tropes about Biden not being with it were completely undermined by Putin, who, after all, is kind of the head of propaganda of the Republican Party. And, you know, so that's a win. You know, I was talking to my friend, who you know well, David Sanger of the New York Times, who's a really well-established writer on cyber. And David made a really good point, which is that summits used to be about nuclear weapons. This was kind of the first summit where cyber was a big chunk of the discussion. Well, that, you know, it's hard to write headlines about that, but the shift, being aware of the shift, making the shift, moving the foreign policy from performative nonsense like Trump to back to substantive discussions. And there were also substantive discussions in progress, I think, and I would expect to see on the Iran deal. There are a bunch of people out there go, oh, well, you know, he didn't pull out of Ukraine and he didn't become a nice guy overnight. But, you know, this is Vladimir Putin. He's one of the most corrupt thugs on the planet Earth. He's not going to change that. That's what he's been through his whole life. The question is the United States going to respond to it in a sensible way and manage it? You know, to me, Biden looks like he's doing it. If I may add one last brief comment on that, Joe Biden became actively involved in U.S. foreign policy when he entered the United States Senate at the age of 30. He was the sixth youngest in American history in 1973. Vladimir Putin, you know, is the leader now. The leader of the then Soviet Union was Leonid Brezhnev. Joe Biden has been around the block, you know, 48 years. You know, everybody talks about George Bush having had, George H.W. Bush, a lot of foreign policy experience before he became president. He had 16 years of foreign policy experience before he became president.
Right.
Joe Biden has three times that.
So the president said that his goal for the meeting was to understand differences and lay the groundwork for future discussion, not an effort to reach substantive agreements. So there are future meetings planned, none laid out very carefully, but the talk of future meetings. What do you believe Putin took away from the meeting with President Biden?
I have to believe, you know, Vladimir Putin's been around a long time too. I have to believe that Vladimir Putin primarily confirmed his theories about Biden at the meeting. You know, it's not like any of this is a surprise to him. He knows what the dividing issues are. He knows where the common interests are. He knows Biden. He's met Biden many times. He knows Biden's team. He knows who they are. And I think the purpose of the meeting was to say, okay, here we are. We're beginning this process. Here are our red lines. Here are the issues that are important to us. Let's find areas where we can make some progress. And rest assured, if we see the GRU meddling in our elections, if we see the GRU behind cyber attacks on the United States, if you make a move in the Baltics, if you undermine, you know, progress in Ukraine further, we're going to have a problem. You know, again, Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, said before the meeting, this is a meeting taking place not because of what the two sides had in common, but because of what differences they had. In other words, they, you know, this was not kumbaya. This was essentially, as one person, senior level person in the government said to me, the goal was to set guardrails. It was to say, if you go outside this line, we're going to have a problem.
Do you believe Putin will abide by those guidelines? Do you have any sense of security that he will not continue to do what he's been doing all along?
No. Of course, I think he's going to do what he's going to do, what he's been doing all along. I mean, you know, that's just who Putin is. And I think he will stay within the guidelines where it benefits him, you know, working on an Iran deal or doing another nuclear deal or possibly beginning some kinds of talks around cyber, because they know that we can do to them with cyber what they can do to us. And I think those are all areas where they're likely to be progress. And I think he will continue to tweak us in Syria. I think he will continue to tweak us with the Turks. I think he will continue to tweak us with Ukraine. And, you know, I think the real question is if things go, and I think he'll do whatever he wants with Navalny and the opposition. And the question becomes, you know, is it, will he go too far? You know, and, you know, that's happened often, right? In 2008, in the run-up to the 2008 presidential elections, he went into Georgia. You know, under Obama, he went into Ukraine. In both cases, the response of the United States was lukewarm. So I think he knows he can get away with it. I think what.
Even with Biden, you think he knows he can get away with it?
Do I think he could invade the Baltics? No. I think NATO would be on that. And I think he knows that, you know, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, they're offline. Can he continue to meddle in Western elections like he has, you know, in, you know, Hungary or, you know, Poland or Italy or France or the United States? Yeah, he will. And he'll continue to try to get away with it on a covert basis because he's a spy. That's what he's done his whole life. He's going to continue to try to do that and get away with it. You know, I think this is all going to be at the margins. How inflammatory will he be in Ukraine? How inflammatory? Or will he pull back a little bit? My guess is, you know, this is a guy who's got his own election coming up, has got his own domestic issues coming up, and he'll do what he thinks looks good for him. If he doesn't have a, you know, every time he had not had a domestic play to gain public support, he makes an aggressive move in the near abroad because it gives him a little bit of a popularity boost.
What happens if Navalny dies, as President Biden referred to?
Outrage.
What good is outrage?
I'm with you. I just don't know. You know, where we go from there. I mean, we could do meaningful sanctions, right? Meaningful sanctions, not the nonsense we've been doing. Well, like identify the 20 people who are best friends of Vladimir Putin and make it impossible for them to do business around the world. You know, go after, when it hurts. We did this, there's an interesting analogy in the 90s in the Clinton administration, in the second part of the Balkan War, and they started bombing Milosevic, and it was having no effect on Milosevic. And then they said, well, who are Milosevic's friends? And they started bombing their factories. And within, 24 hours, Milosevic's buddies were on the phone going, hey, do something. My factory is going to be destroyed. Don't let this happen. And it had an effect. And so I think, if you really want to have an effect, you've got to, hit him where it hurts. And where it hurts is the oligarchs around him who support him and his massive multi-hundred-billion-dollar kind of criminal enterprise.
What about the exchange of prisoners? What about the two Americans being held and a number of Russians being held in the U.S.?
Listening to Putin, who addressed that, you have to believe there's a possibility that'll happen.
Really?
Yeah, I think there's a... That's the kind of small thing that's no skin off them, his back, that if he gets some credit for it, he'll do it.
Wouldn't he get more credit letting Navalny go if Navalny left the country?
He might. Navalny, I don't know that Navalny would commit to staying out of the country. Remember, Navalny came back.
I know.
And I think Navalny came back knowing that exactly what is happening now was the most likely outcome. I think he sees Navalny as a kind of a mortal threat. And, he's seen what's happened in Belarus. He's seen the demonstrations in the street. He saw when Navalny was arrested, demonstrations, in withering snowstorms across the 11 time zones of Russia. And for, I think that the most important thing to realize here is for Vladimir Putin, Alexei Navalny is not an issue of foreign policy with the West. It's an issue of existential domestic politics. And he's going to play it that way.
And if he dies in custody, what does the U.S. do?
I think the U.S. protests. I think the U.S. puts in sanctions. I think the U.S. may recall its ambassador again, although we've just returned him there with this meeting. I think, there are things like that that we'll do. I don't think we'll do anything that will change the behavior of Vladimir Putin. If Navalny dies, there's not going to be any summits with Putin for a year or two after that, right? There's certain things that will stop as a result of all of that. I hope that the response is strong. I'm not optimistic because, invading Ukraine is about as bad as it gets, and our response was not strong.
More of my conversation with David Rothkopf when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with David Rothkopf. He's CEO of the Rothkopf Group, host of Deep State Radio, and author of the book titled Traitor, A History of American Betrayal from Benedict Arnold to Donald Trump. So How seriously does Putin want a better relationship with the U.S. and its allies?
I don't think he thinks of the world that way. I think Vladimir Putin wants to be secure in his power. I think he wants Russia to be perceived as a great power again. I think he wants to have influence. I think he wants to help provide for enough people within the oligarchy of Russia to ensure that he's safe. And it's all about self-interest. That's what happens in a country that's an autocracy. It's not about national interests. It's about the self-interest of the leader.
So did Biden do him a certain amount of good by meeting with him? Should he have skipped a meeting with Putin?
I think Biden did him a certain amount of good because it establishes him as a crucial counterpart on the world stage. But I think that had Biden not done it, then we would hear an outcry, is Biden afraid of Putin? Will he not meet with him, et cetera, et cetera? And, you know, it's a coin toss. I mean, you know, it's like the same ridiculous argument that's being made right now about when is Kamala Harris going to go to the border? You know, I mean, couldn't be less relevant. Lots of people in the administration are dealing with that. Her issues in her mandate are with Mexico and with Central America. But if she goes to the border, she's going to be immediately held accountable for every problem that exists on the border. And if she doesn't, she's going to be told, you know, it's kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. I think if you're doing responsible U.S. foreign policy, you meet with Putin, you meet with Xi Jinping, you meet with, you know, your principal rivals and adversaries, because that's what you do in foreign policy. And you send a message to them and you try to, A, make things better, and B, keep them from getting worse.
How much can we actually know as to whether Putin himself or people within Russia, unbeknownst to Putin, have interfered with our elections and have carried out cyber attacks?
I think we know enough now to know that Putin was behind interfering with the election, that nobody in the Russian intelligence services is going to interfere as they did in 2016, certainly without the explicit approval of Putin. And I think there was some indication in some of the investigations that took place that these things were approved at the Putin level. The same is true with cyber attacks on the United States, because of course, you know, and this is what many are worried about with cyber attacks, to the extent to which you're discovered for doing it, the consequences can be great. And, you know, the United States has the ability to shut down plenty of infrastructure in Russia, just as Russia has the ability to meddle with us. Putin's buying this stuff. The U.S. knows it. I suspect Biden has said that to him. You know, Biden had two phone calls with Putin before the meeting. And in the second of the phone calls, I mean, he was talking about cyber and essentially was saying, and Ukraine also, don't cross this line. You know, we know you guys do this. We will respond. I think there will be tests. I just, you know, cyber is a whole new realm. We still don't know how to respond. There's still no doctrine for how to respond to a cyber attack in the United States. There's still no bright line when a cyber attack warrants a kinetic response. And I think we need to, they're going to test it until we find out.
How do you account for the fact that Republicans seem to support Putin perhaps more than they support our own president?
You know, I feel like, you know, I ate a bad mushroom or something. You know, I mean, to me, you know, this was the opposite of what you know, any U.S. politician would have embraced for 70 years, right? And you know, at some point in the past 5-10 years, beginning with marginal players like Dana Rohrabacher and some of these other characters, but then accelerating dramatically with Trump and Flynn and so forth. And now, you know, batches of Republican senators going over there. I think what they've done is they've rationalized it. They said Russia's not our, you know, the enemy it was. And Russia can help us win. And we're going to embrace that. And of course, Russia played this game extremely cannily. I mean, you know, one thing that we haven't discussed here, and I'm surprised it doesn't get discussed enough, is the amount of money Russia pumped into the NRA. You know, Russia was pumping money into the bloodstream of the Republican Party and into some of these key races, and Russian oligarchs were doing deals in Mitch McConnell's home state, you know, that benefited Mitch McConnell, made him look like a big winner. To them, you know, Russia is no different from, you know, accepting the support of white supremacists. And honestly, the analogy is not bad. They'll take whoever they can get to stay in power, regardless of how odious or even criminal they are.
In the last few days, there have been revelations about just how hard Trump was working after the election to overturn the results. Could Putin have been involved in that?
I don't know. But what I do know is that unless Trump and Mark Meadows and, you know, Lindsey Graham and other people who were involved in this process at a high level are put before some kind of a magistrate who has real subpoena power and who has the power to take away their freedom, and they're forced to speak on the record, we're never going to know. We're never going to know. And, you know, this is what I fear, you know, there seems to be a kind of hesitance to seek the accountability that is the only way to preserve our system right now. I mean, Mueller identified a dozen cases of obstruction of justice. Now, he wasn't tiptoeing around it. He was saying, this is obstruction of justice. When the president is not the president anymore, he should be vulnerable. He should be, you know, prosecutable. As far as we know, nothing has happened. The president said, let's bring together a bunch of people and try to stop this process of approving the ballots in the Congress. And it happened, and it led to an insurrection. And nobody can bring themselves to investigate it. The FBI director this week said, as far as he knows, there's no investigation into the president, into Trump's involvement in this. I mean, we had a wife of a Supreme Court justice writing checks to get the busloads of people to show up for this thing. No investigation of that whatsoever. We had massive evidence for several months before this event that it was going to happen. On the internet, warnings from the president via Twitter, people coming. The FBI even says that they, you know, identified a dozen or 20 people who were going to come, and they told them not to come. So they knew what was going on, but they didn't stop it. They didn't stop it when they saw the internet awareness. They didn't stop it when they got on the buses. They didn't stop it when they gathered on the mall. They didn't stop it when they started marching up to the Capitol. They didn't stop, and no one was sent for a couple hours after that. And we're not asking why, because why is a big question, right? It's a big question. Why didn't, you know, and I'm sure the answer, by the way, is that the president of the United States made it known directly or by implication that he wouldn't approve of that kind of behavior, of intervening with, you know, against these people. And so we have a multi avenue attack on American democracy going on, whether it's undermining elections or working with foreign governments to undermine those elections or suppressing the ballot or having a coup attempt. And, you know, you tell me, you follow all this stuff too. Do you see any place where there's real accountability, where people are, you know, we're getting to the bottom of the truth, where anybody but sort of irrelevant foot soldiers are being held accountable? And the answer is no. And if we don't, it's going to happen again.
So finally, as far as Vladimir Putin and our allies and our president are concerned, you say that the big job ahead is the slow work of diplomacy. How much is that going to take? And will it succeed in tamping down this threat to democracy, at least around the world?
The first thing I'd say is, unless we address it at home, it's going to weaken our ability to deal with it around the world, right? But in terms of, you know, the conduct of U.S. foreign policy, which will go on whether Democrats are in the majority or not, you know, this Biden's going to be doing this for 4 years. It certainly makes a difference if Biden adheres more closely to democracies, supports international institutions, supports the rule of law internationally, has allies that are, think the same way on these issues. And I think there will be areas where progress will be made. There will be progress made on helping to combat COVID. There will be progress made on helping to combat the climate crisis. There will be progress made, I suspect, quite soon on getting back into the Iran nuclear deal. I suspect that there will be progress made on multilateral agreements regarding cyber, perhaps trade and technology, and perhaps more control of nuclear weapons. Well, you know, that doesn't solve all the problems we've got, but the world would be better off in 4 years if we make progress on those things than if we don't.
Before we close, is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners?
It's a critical moment in the life of the country. A lot of people felt that when Joe Biden won, Trump was defeated, we'd turned the page. And in fact, what we learned in the wake of January 6th was that the movement that you might call Trumpism or the movement of the far right in the United States only accelerated. Not only was there a coup, but you now have 240 different efforts to suppress the vote. You have obstacles within the Congress to stopping that. You have warning lights all flashing red that suggest that U.S. democracy is going to be less effective, that the minority is going to gain more power, that those who are negatively affected disproportionately are going to be people of color and the poor, that the views of the few are going to more likely prevail. And if that's the case, then the character of the country is at risk. As we record this, this is the first year we're celebrating as a nation the Juneteenth holiday, which talked about a moment where the country took one of its original sins and undid it. There are others among the original sins and the way this country was set up, that disproportionate, you know, the way that, for example, power was allocated to in the Senate, that remain with us. And we have to remember that the history of a country like ours is not exclusively one of progress. We are not vouchsafed a happy ending here. And you know, I would hope that your listeners saw, if they care about democracy, if they care about the country, at least the aspirational values we've always had for it, that they will see it as their individual responsibility to do something to ensure that we preserve it. Because if we don't have a massive movement of people trying to preserve it, we know there's already a massive movement of people trying to undermine it, and they're going to win.
So you would say vote.
Vote, donate, volunteer, put up a yard sign, meet in your community, get on the internet, share your views, persuade your family at the Thanksgiving table, use the tools of citizenship every day.
David Rothkopf, thank you.
Thank you.
That was David Rothkopf. He's CEO of the Rothkopf Group, host of Deep State Radio, and author of the book titled Traitor, A History of American Betrayal from Benedict Arnold to Donald Trump. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Thanks for listening, all. Be well, stay safe. I'm Diane Reams.